Hey.
We're here.
Hey, we're recording. Hey, welcome to the podcast. You're here with producer Jimmy Kennedy today. I'm Noah
Hey, no,
Hassler. Hey,
thanks.
brother. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we were just talking before the show about podcasting, right? Because you're the expert on podcasting and I'm the novice.
That's what you say, man. Yeah, we're trying to figure out what the best platform is for Noel Castler. That's at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, getting Noel established and ready to go. So,
Thank you, man. How's the weather out there?
snow on the ground. It's a very temperate 45 in Indianapolis today. So, we might get a little suntan lotion on and get some rays, but we'll see.
Nice. It's snowing here right now. It's always snowing these days. It's like Game of Thrones.
Yep. Yeah.
Getting ready to go beyond the wall at this point, you know?
Yep.
So,
Absolutely.
let's talk about some headlines, man. Did you read about this Ted Cruz thing? Obviously, this whole debacle, you know, which is just a scam. Like these guys don't care. You know, his wife is a big managing director at Goldman Sachs in the energy sector, you know, the private wealth fund there in Houston, you know. So shit was party time when that happened. They know how their energy grid is set up. They know that private companies can jack the rates when the demand goes up. So it was a windfall. And she went to celebrate down in Cancun and he went with her and wasn't coming home, dude.
Yeah.
Had to, you know.
I mean, it was I saw the different memes of, Ted Cruz and making fun of his Cancun trip. The one that I couldn't get out of my mind was the guy who stole the podium during the insurrection. They had, Ted Cruz's face and a margarita, tipping the other way as he's, waving to the camera. So
That's funny.
it's unreal how shameless these folks really are at the end of the day. It's
I know.
sad.
Exactly. And why do they want the jobs? You know, here's my thing. Like all these guys, they get elected and they get the jobs and they go golfing. They go to Cancun. Like you don't want the gig. You're like old white man with a lot of money. Why don't you just go do like old white man stuff? Like why don't you just go play golf? You know, why don't you go kayaking? Like build a gazebo, you know, make beer. Like, you know, why don't you get out of the way and let the people that want to take over take over? They're not going to muscle you out. They're just going to roll up their sleeves and go to work. And AOC is a perfect example of that, you know. Representative Plaskett, Stacey Plaskett from the U.S. Virgin Islands. You know, we're getting some real heroes that are coming forward in this time because that's what happens is like there's it's progress, you know, and we have to stop looking at it from a place of fear. You know, Trumpism was about making people fearful. Like these people are coming to take your, they're not coming to take anything. They're coming to work hard, you know. Like I used to do a joke in my set about caravans, and he was like, they're invaders, you know, and I'm like, they're not invaders. Those are hungry men and women looking for jobs and a place to raise their kids that is safe, you know. Like that's the kind of people you want to hire, you know. Like, how'd you get here today? You take a subway? No, I walked from Guatemala. Okay, you're hired. You know what I mean? That guy's going to show up on time and he's going to work his butt off, you know? But there's been a system where it's like a lot of people made money that they were able to hand off generationally. You know, it's generational wealth. So it's like your kid doesn't have to work that hard and be that smart because he's born a certain way and he's going to go to the right country club and he's going to join the right fraternity at Vanderbilt. And then when he gets out of Vanderbilt, he's going to call his fraternity brother who's got a job at Goldman Sachs, and that guy's going to get dumbass a job. And then he's going to snort coke for 8 years and not get fired. And then they're going to send him to rehab. And then he's going to settle down and have a few grandkids, and the cycle will get repeated, you know, and it's a comfortable, cushy life. And I know it, you know, I live in that world. I live on the Upper East Side. Like, you know, I'm in recovery. Like, you've never seen white privilege until you've been into like an AA meeting on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, dude. Because like people screw up so big time and never get fired. You know, this is like, oh, we're gonna send you to like rehab or something. You know, you're at UPS or something, you're at Amazon like collecting stuff, and you have pot in your urine, you get fired. You know, there's a different set of rules in this country, and it's been designed to protect the ruling class, for lack of a better term. And nowhere is that more prevalent than in the South. You know, you see that with Tom Cotton. You know, Tom Cotton was basically attacking racial equity yesterday. You know, he was basically saying anything that makes the playing field fair is unfair to the white man. You know, his ancestors owned slaves, you know, in Arkansas. You know, it's like he's been passed on generations of wealth, and that has become part of the firmament of this society. And the if you want to take it a step further, it's like the guys that control this know that if they manipulate sort of the working class, lower middle class, resentful whites, then those guys aren't going to look at who really has the power. You know, because Mitch McConnell isn't looking out for the people of Kentucky that keep voting for him. You know, he's worth $20 million. He's looking out for himself, you know, but he's convinced the guy in the coal mine that through his racism and through his like Second Amendment, you know, boisterism or whatever you want to call it, he's looking out for those guys, you know, and it's just not that way. You know, do you know who Howard Zinn is, Jimmy?
I don't.
It's all good. Howard Zinn was a professor at Boston University. He wrote a book called The People's History of the United States, which is it came out in 1980. And it was basically like the real history of this country, not what they teach you in the classrooms, which was like Christopher Columbus was a hero and he came and discovered America. Like, no, he went to the Caribbean and he slaughtered people because he wanted gold, you know, and he enslaved people like he was a monster, you know, who was looking to make money. And he didn't actually ever set foot in North America. But you're taught this thing, you know, I pledge allegiance to the flag, you know, and there's a lot of good things about America and this democracy, but there's also a lot of exploitation. And that's one of the earliest lessons of this country is that the guys that own the factories, you know, the industrialists, and before that, the guys that own the plantations, you know, they had indentured servants and they had enslaved people, right? And they sort of figured out it's going to be easier if the indentured servants resent the enslaved people, you know, that come from Africa, than if they turn and look at the Europeans that are holding them down, you know, the white European males that are owning the land. It's like, we don't want them figuring out that we're making 90% of the money. You know, let's let these guys fight over the crumbs that we give them. And that model has taken in this country. And the only time that it was pushed back upon was like a union labor movements that happened, you know, that was fought against like vociferously. They would go and shoot people down who were organizing, you know, in Manhattan and the sweatshops and the garment districts and stuff. You know, the industrialists fought tooth and nail to like destroy the advent of unions, but then unions happened. You know, unions happened and it provide a livable wage. And not only that, like people flustered, you know, flourish. There you go. That's why you're here, Jimmy. That's what a good producer does. They flourished when we built this middle class. And then after World War II, you had the New Deal, right? The New Deal sort of came about from the Depression, but that's basically democratic socialism. You know, we had the GI Bill. So you came back from serving your country and you grew up in a household that was Depression era and you didn't even barely have enough to eat. And all of a sudden you got to go to college after serving the war, you know, or you got to go work in a factory where you made enough money to buy two cars, have a wife who could stay home and put three kids in college. You know, and buy a home in the suburbs. You know, we built Levittown, Long Island. We built all these suburbs and we built a middle class. And then we built sort of the richest nation on earth in the 50s and 60s. That, you know, that became like the model. And that was the American dream. Like if you worked hard, you would be rewarded and the next generation would go that much further. That got done away with during Reagan's era. You know, Reagan came in, it was like slash all that stuff. You know, forget about the unions. They're evil. The Democrats are liberals. They're socialists. They're bad. Greed is good. You know, and that's when I came of age in the 80s. I saw Reagan come in and cut school lunch programs and cut funding and all that kind of stuff for the arts. He was attacking my friends. You know, I grew up in a poor neighborhood with a single mom who had me at 19 when I was in elementary school. You know, I got a couple perspectives because I later lived with my grandparents in the suburbs of New York City in a more well-to-do area. But when I was in, you know, struggling in elementary school, living with a single mom, my friends were, it was a mixed race neighborhood, you know, and we would get bused to these schools in a nice white suburb and kids would eat free breakfast. They had a free breakfast and a free lunch program. Reagan came in and cut those programs. You know, he said ketchup is a vegetable, you know? So I saw my friends go hungry and I saw the results of that stuff, you know, and it just, it sort of spread out from there. You know, it became like corporate America was king now, you know, and whatever turned a profit for your board of directors was okay. It was Reaganism that did that. You know, that's what sent all your companies overseas, because CEOs realized, hey, I can build this thing in China for a lot cheaper than America, you know. But at the same time that was happening, which was the worst enemy to the sort of the middle class white American male that or family that we structure that we just described, at the same time that was happening, they were also demonizing the left, you know. Carter was a great president. He was a progressive, brilliant guy, you know, but they were able to sort of paint him as this liberal and, you know, he was ineffectual and you needed a tough John Wayne-like character like Reagan, you know, who was basically like a racist who instituted racist policies. He wouldn't admit the AIDS crisis happened. You know, there was a plague on America and he wouldn't admit it. But they were able to sort of like brand that kind of idealism. And a guy named Lee Atwater was crucial in that. He was the campaign director for Bush and came out of that Reagan era. So my point, this is a long-winded point, but they were able to sort of sell the people that live in the suburbs, you know, the guys that work as contractors, the guys that worked in those factories, you know, that were now on an economic downturn in life. They were able to sell them the idea that like the Democrats, you know, and these highfalutin elites that went to Yale, like Bill Clinton and stuff, you know, weren't on their side, you know, when in actuality they were. You know, Obama was one of the best things that could have happened to the middle class here in America. Universal health care is a great idea. You know, you want health care. That's where it's going. You know, the people in Kentucky need that stuff. But if you're able to package it in a way that people think it's from the other, you know, and it's foreign to your way of life, it's a very effective thing. And then you couple that with like waving a flag or waving a gun, you know, and you get these gun cultist freaks that are just like, they're coming for your guns. First of all, that's the dumbest thing you've ever heard. There's 400 million guns in America. You know, there's like three guns for every person. You know, they're not coming for all those guns. You know, if you're a smart dude and you know you got a bunch of guns, ain't nobody coming for them. Stick them in the closet, put them in the basement or whatever. Like no one's going to find them. You know, you got enough firepower in this country to last for the rest of time, you know? So the whole argument the NRA makes, that's about selling guns for gun manufacturers. It's not for the, you know, owners. It's a lobbying arm of gun manufacturers, you know, but it's been sold as a lifestyle brand. And Trump and Trumpism sort of codified that whole thing into this WrestleMania brand of like, I'm down with those guys. You know, that's I'm team Hulk Hogan, you know, or no offense to Hulk Hogan, but you know what I mean? You're the wrestling guy, but you know, it was a lifestyle thing. And I see them here in New York. I'm an hour outside of the city and guys drive by in their pickups with their don't tread on me stickers and their Blue Lives Matter flags, you know. Blue lives do matter, but you know what? The same people with those flags just killed a bunch of cops. You know, there's hearings as we speak on Capitol Hill today, and they're trying to, Ron Johnson is sitting there trying to say like, hey, wasn't it really Antifa that did this? And you guys are just trying to make Trump bad. It was Trump who did it. He was selling bus rides on his Twitter feed a week before the thing, you know, but if you sell it back to the people like, nope, that's the bad guys and you're the good guys. It's very effective. You know, that's how terrorism takes hold in the Middle East. You know, they go into poor neighborhoods and say, hey, you know, the reason your life sucks is because these guys are keeping you down. You know, they do it in Palestine, where they are kept down, you know, but like you're able to like people that have healthy, rich, rewarding lives don't like often go out and kill other people, you know, as part of a movement. But people that have a lot of anger and they don't see a way out of it, and you're able to feed them the lie that if it wasn't just for these other people, you'd be fine. You know, that's a powerful thing that, you know, we've seen what damage it does in the world. I mean, that's how Hitler came to power, you know? So that's the first part of today's rant. What do you think about that, Jimmy? A lot of jokes in there, huh?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the Trump administration being a WWE kind of promotion. Let's not forget, one of the first things that Trump held that I think it was Trump Plaza was WrestleMania. He's been involved with Vince McMahon for a number of years. His wife was the small business administrator in his administration. So he's not completely foreign to the idea of professional wrestling. And a lot of fans, from my experience, actually believe that these characters are those people. They don't realize that it's a kayfabe. You know, it's a fake thing, the idea of professional wrestling. And it's very similar. You know, those, if you look at the rallies, it's very similar to a WWE professional wrestling kind of event, the way that it's promoted and talked about on the news, you know.
That's well said, man. It's exactly what it's like. And the whole thing is a show too. You know, I would tell people about, like, CNN was run by Jeff Zucker. You know, Jeff Zucker was the head of NBC Entertainment when I worked on Celebrity Apprentice. You know, he knew all about who Trump was back then, you know, and he knew all about who Trump was in 2015 and 16, but he kept his mouth shut because there was a lot of money to be made, you know, and people are like, well, CNN is liberal. Well, it's not really, you know, they have on, you know, the guy from Pennsylvania, you know, the horrible guy that everybody hates, you know who I'm talking about.
Well, I'm more of a MSNBC fan, but I've checked in on CNN, but even MSNBC is starting to drift to be more conservative. You have Michael Steele on all the time. Bill Kristol is another conservative that they have on all the time. So
Bill's a smart guy, though. Bill's not, I mean, Bill follows me on Twitter, so shout out to Bill. How you doing, Bill?
Bill, you're a good guy.
Exactly. Who's the guy from Pennsylvania? He was like sort of a real evil guy in the 90s, 2000.
I'll look it up.
And Dan Savage used to like make fun of him. Santorum, Rick Santorum.
Oh, okay. Yep.
They made a dirty word out of what Santorum made because he was a real homophobic guy back in the day, like Christian conservative, you know, so. There was a very rude thing that became what you call Santorum. I won't go into it here. We're a family show. But anyway, my point is Jeff Zucker knew there was a lot of money in the fight, you know, in tuning in, because there's always like a bad guy and a good guy, you know, but the dude who owns the event is the one making the money. So Trump, you know, he was going to Trump fundraisers in the Hamptons. He knew Trump was going to be a cash cow, and now he's leaving CNN because Trump's out of there, you know, so he made a big windfall and now he's out of there. And that's why I tell people, like, you got to verify sort of where you get news. Like, news is entertainment. Like, if it's on TV, it's not really kind of news. You know, it's a corporate arm of an organization that makes you money. You know, Mary Trump followed me today, and Mary Trump's, you know, a big hero to many people. And, you know, when she wrote her book and it came out, and like Rachel Maddow was like, Mary Trump talks about Trump using the N-word. It's like, I had said that years ago. You know, Kwame Jackson said it in 1990, 2004, rather, when he was on the show. You know, Holly Robinson said it. You know, other people have said he used the N-word. But when a white woman who had a contract with Simon & Schuster, which is next door to MSNBC on 6th Avenue in New York City, had, you know, when there was a corporation to make money off of it, it all of a sudden became breaking news. And that's what I try to tell people about. Like, you got to look at the profit structure and things, because it runs all throughout American life. And that's what, you know, Howard Zinn, his whole thing was, you know, it was just like, you have to look at what's motivating the political discourse in America, because there's usually money behind it, you know?
Yeah. And one thing that really disgusts me about this whole facade going on with the Republican Party is the weaponization of Christianity. You know, they've tied the success of America to the success of God. And then they make people that aren't conservative Christians feel guilty about caring about people from outside the United States. They've dehumanized the idea of immigration when we have all the resources to make this the best country in the world for everyone, if we choose to. But it's the fact that we are choosing not to do so that I think is the most disappointing part of being an American right now.
Oh, man, yeah. Oh, Jimmy, I made a joke yesterday that, you know, everybody was talking about CPAC, you know, uninvited a speaker. And I said they uninvited Jesus because they found out he wanted to feed the poor, you know, and it's like, Jesus was an immigrant, you know, and he would have been thrown in a cage if he stumbled across America in Trump's age, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they showed a picture of what Jesus would have looked like. He had bronze skin.
Exactly.
He wasn't white.
No,
you know, that's the image that they want you to see.
I know.
And you know, so it's horrible the way that they are using things to manipulate folks.
I know. And, you know, my family worked, like my grandmother was friends with the Berrigans, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, who were like the radical priests. Have you ever heard the Paul Simon song? They talk about the radical priests. You know, they were anti-Vietnam priests. You know, they were Jesuit priests who fought for like sort of what was right and fought against injustice. You know, and that guy in Buffalo this summer, you remember the old man who got knocked down by the cops and they kept walking? So that guy was a Jesuit, you know. They've always been on the front line of human, you know, humanitarian causes. Sister Helen Prejean is has been an anti death penalty advocate like no other for decades. But so that's my point is that's real Christianity, you know, is reaching out and trying to help those, you know, less fortunate. It's not the, you know, hey, send me $10 and you two can have a jet, you know, like. Yeah. And now Christianity is like Christo fascism. You know, it's like you see all these Twitter pages with pictures of Trump, like the second coming of Christ. There is nobody more unchrist-like than Donald J. Trump. You know, there's a great, you want to say something?
Well, no, I mean, it's, I was going to say, I was thinking of, that new movie that's out, the Messiah, the Black Messiah versus Judas. On HBO Max, and they talk, it's about the rise of the Black Panthers in Chicago and how, you know, if it's for poor people, it's socialism.
Right.
But if it's for the well off, that's democracy.
Exactly.
You know, it's just, it's the way that we frame things. And the way you're just talking about it, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I got to meet Afeni Shakur, who was one of the original Black Panthers. And she was also the mom of Tupac Shakur. You got to meet her and Biggie Smalls, Violetta Smalls at the VMAs, sadly, after both of their kids were murdered or assassinated or whatever. They were shot dead. And they both came together to do a tribute at a VMAs we did once. And they were my assignment. And it was an honor to meet them. You know, and the Black Panthers, that's a story that hasn't been told, you know, or it's been told by the perspective of white folks that feared them, you know. And you look at this summer, you saw the Michigan State Capitol, you know, and all those guys showing up with guns, walking into the state capitol, you know, threatening to kill the governor. If those guys had been Black, that would have been like, they would have called in the National Guard. It would have been a war, you know. They're same at, you know, the U.S. Capitol, you know. If those guys, you know, those guys, they were standing down at the U.S. Capitol. I used to work on Capitol Hill. I was a bike messenger there, you know, from 89 to about 92. I would ride a bike for the Congressional Budget Office and I would deliver packages and stuff and House documents. And back then, the House document room was in the rotunda of the Capitol. It was on the second floor. And you'd go up there and you'd say, I need H.R. 2616 or whatever. And they'd give you the document. And then I would get on my bike and I would ride it down to, you know, a law firm on K Street. And it was a good way to make money in the late 80s. You know, it was before email and really in faxes and all. Well, faxes existed, but it was a different world, you know. So you could make like $700 a week riding a bike around DC. You know, it was just pretty cool. But my point is, I knew my way around that building because I was in there every day and I got lost all the time. You know, because you used to always hand deliver things. So if you had to bring something to the speaker's office, it was hard to find this stuff. But these guys went in there and they knew exactly where to go in a building that ostensibly they'd never been in before in their lives that was designed to be confusing in case it was ever attacked, you know. And then it was attacked and they knew exactly where to go. So, and there was no cops around. And back then they would yell at us if we rode through a crosswalk on our bikes, there would be hell to pay. You know, they'd blow their whistles and pull us over and harass us. But, you know, these guys just got to go attack it because, you know, well, we know why, you know, because of the color of their skin.
Well, and it's just, it's sad that, you know, the Capitol is the symbol of our democracy. And it's the symbol of the democracy, of democracy around the world. And for it to be tarnished in such a way like that, I think the thing that worries me, I'm only 26. I have to deal with this. What I'm worried about is folks my age and younger that have been indoctrinated already. They're watching Fox News all day. They're listening to talk radio and they're seeing all these images and they're getting indoctrinated at this point already. You know, what are we going to do one generation from now, two generations from now? I think it'll take that long before we're ultimately back at a point where democracy is viewed favorably among, you know, the masses. At this point, it's about 50-50 with the way that we look at the vote, you know, and it's scary to see it unfold like this. really is.
Absolutely. That's well said, Jimmy. That's actually one of my themes, you know, that I constantly tell people. It's like, I'm worried about the children that have been growing up in these households for the last 4 and 5 years with parents that are believing the QAnon stuff, you know, like that are believing Fox News, that are listening to Sean Hannity, that are being told it was Antifa that really attacked the Capitol, you know, because that's what they're being told today. Senator Ron Johnson is putting it in the record. You know, he's asking questions designed to put that in the record. Like, wasn't it true that Antifa was really behind the attacks and it just wanted to make Trump look bad? It doesn't matter if that's patently false, because it is. It's a massive lie. It's already weaponized propaganda when it comes out of his mouth, because it gives the people hearing it an excuse to say, see, Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, said it's not true. And what happens with that shit, and sorry to curse, but like, a guy hears that and then he tells his buddy at the bar after work the same thing. And then that guy wants to feel smart in front of his wife, so he repeats that lie to his wife. And then his kids sitting there at the dinner table looking up to dad hear it. And then they say it to their buddies, you know, in the classroom. And it's also fun to pick on the weak people, you know, so, and the others. So a lot of the bullyism that Trump, you know, made so popular, I fear for, like, you know, Mexican children in elementary schools and Middle Eastern kids and gay kids and anybody who's different, you know, when you're dumb and you're young, it's easy to participate in like a gang sort of mentality. So to have that legitimized, you know, and sort of validated at such high levels is terrifying. You know, like, what are Lauren Boebert's kids gonna be like? You know, I wish them the best, but you know what I mean?
Well, the most disgusting thing that Trump did, I mean, I even after Trump was elected, as an American, I said to myself, look, I'll give him a couple weeks, you know, we'll see what happens, because that's fair. I'm fair. And then he mocks the reporter with a disability on live TV. You know, what does he do in private if he's doing that on live TV?
Right.
Like, and for the people that don't understand, if you go to journalism school, communication school, whatever, one of the first things you're taught is that the media is a watchdog on government. It's designed to protect the people from government. And there is corporate interest now, so it is a little more blurred than it used to be. But the idea that the media is the enemy of the people, no, that is the complete opposite idea. And it's exactly how, you know, other authoritarians rose to power, is discrediting the media.
Absolutely. So, and that's why it was the first thing he did. You know, he's like, don't believe, you know, what you read, believe what I say. Because he also knew how many skeletons he had in his closet. You know, the guy has done some horrific things, you know, vice crimes, sexual assaults, rapes, like, you name it. He's been involved with skanky, dirty stuff since the 70s. Stuff that was no secret in New York City. Everybody knew who Trump was. He hired NYPD cops as a security detail, so he got away with it. You know, if you were a woman running out of a room that he just attacked you in, and you ran into a big ex-NYPD police sergeant, you know, who was going to be like, nothing happened, you know, I'm getting you a cab, you know, and then his lawyer shows up a day later with a check and says, sign an NDA, you're going to do it, because the guy's name is on the side of the building and he's best friends with the mayor, you know, Giuliani. So that's how Trump got away with that thuggery forever. But he knew people knew about it, because the thing about Trump is he's got a big mouth, you know, so he knew eventually something was going to come out. He knows Putin has all that compromise on him. So it, like you said, the first thing was like, yeah, don't believe what you hear, even what you're saying about disabilities. Like, you saw that he did that at a rally. Imagine the stuff he did like behind the scenes, because I saw it. He called that wonderful actress who's deaf, who was a contestant. He called her retarded. That's his word, not mine. He's like, what is she, retarded? You know, because she speaks, her speech is a little affected. I've done Super Bowls with her. Like, she's a brilliant person. And, you know, when he was building Trump Tower, he got in an elevator once and, you know, he was inspecting it and he's hitting the buttons and he's like, what are these little bumps? Why are there little bumps on all these numbers and stuff? And they're like, that's Braille. You know, that's for blind people. And he goes, blind people aren't going to live in my building. You know, he's ableist. You know, he's a sexist, ableist, racist scumbag. His family was like that. You know, his grandfather was, you know, his kids are worse. His kid, Don Jr., is like 100 times worse than Donald Trump. If you can imagine such a thing, it's true.
Well, and I saw that video of him with the guns in the background. That looked like a terrorist video, man.
Exactly.
Like what you would see from Al Qaeda. I mean, right? Visually?
It is. They're building an army. It is Al Qaeda. They're basically saying, we're here to fight. This isn't going away because it's power and it's an entrenchment of power for the Trump family. You know, because the flip side of that is jail and getting in trouble for tax evasion and stuff, you know. But if you have an army willing to take up arms for you and attack the Capitol, you're going to be less likely to like go after him in your home state. You know, Houston's going to be less likely to sue them or San Antonio for the money he still owes them for his rallies. You know, he wants people to come down to Mar-a-Lago and be like, you ain't taking him alive. You know, like, because if he gets a warrant for his arrest in New York, he's going to be in Florida. And damn, like, if Governor DeSantis won't do all he can to protect him, you know, can you imagine having a standoff in Florida? It could happen. He could say, take up your arms and protect the president. The governor's not going to let, you know, New York cops come in here and take me away. And, you know, it's a final stand and they want bloodshed. So, yes, Don Jr. posing with those guns, you know, if he was again, if he was a black guy doing that, he'd be getting a knock on the door. You know, Lauren Boebert is doing it as a congressman. Like, it's insane. But they're thugs. They're mobster thugs that are deeply criminal, and they have deep criminal ties, and they're willing to do anything. And that's why they got away with it in New York, because everybody knew he was mobbed up. People are like, I'm not messing with the mob, you know?
Does there stand any hope that he will be charged in the state of New York? They just got his taxes, right? The Supreme Court said that they're not going to block them from the state level.
That's the word. I mean, I got friends who are former SDNY prosecutors that swear he's going down, that he's getting charged, you know. I'm going to be the last line of skepticism on that, you know, because I've seen him get away with everything, you know, since I was in high school. So I have a hard time seeing him really going down, because I think he can tie it all up legally. A lot of this stuff is civil charges and stuff, you know, like, so I think, you know, the odds of him getting handcuffed and booked and stuff, which again, my friend in the SDNY says is going to happen, and I'll be dancing in the streets naked the day it does. I'll be down there in front of Trump Tower laughing my ass off, but I got to see it happen, because to me, it isn't going to happen. He's got lawyers. He can, you know, you rich people have a different kind of set of justice. You know, they can get stays and all kinds of things, and they can get probation, or, you know, they can get bail and all this stuff. So, you know, I don't think he's going to be doing any perp walks, but I sure hope he does. But I don't see him ever going to jail, because I think he would like off himself before. You know, I just don't think his ego could handle that. You know, I think he would be like, you know, El Chapo or so. You know, El Chapo went to jail. Who is the guy in Medellin cartel? You know, the other guy who died on the rooftop in Colombia, Bogota or something. You know.
Oh, that's right. Pablo Escobar. Is
Pablo
that?
Escobar. Exactly. Trump is the, he's not, you're not coming and taking him alive. You know, he's going to hole up in Mar-a-Lago and you're going to have to like shoot it out with his bodyguards before you get him out of there, in my opinion. He's not just like, all right, I'm going to go to jail. And he's 74 anyway. And he's, you know, his arteries are full of bacon fat, you know, like
I
the
was going
guy.
to say, his personal health has to be alarming to some folks around him, I would think.
Well, nobody gives a shit about him. They hate him. So, like, nobody would be happier for him to keel over than his daughter and his sons. They despise him. But, you know, a lot of people, sometimes guys just don't die. You know, karma isn't fair like that, you know, because with his diet and his drug addiction, he should have been dead a long time ago, but he's not. You know, and we'll on a lighter note, you know, there's a Washingtonian had a great article last week about like Trump Tower, you know, the hotel rather, Trump Hotel DC, and like the restaurant there, the BLT Prime restaurant steakhouse, you know. And Trump was like, he would have these shrimp, right, that he would have every day. It was the same thing. And that's how it was when I worked with him. It was like he had to have meatloaf or well done steak or something. Like he eats the same thing over and over. So every time he came into the restaurant, a guy had to appear with a Diet Coke on a silver platter, open it in front of him to make sure it wasn't poisoned or something, you know? And then he had to immediately be served shrimp cocktail, right? But his shrimp had to be bigger than anybody else he was dining with, right? So they had like super extra large shrimp for him. And then, you know, everyone else was getting 16, 20 count shrimp on their plate, you know? Hey, speaking of shrimp cocktail, you know, that was invented in Indianapolis.
Yeah, we have the St. Elmo's shrimp cocktail that everybody gets to try. And that's also a natural COVID test. If you can't smell or taste that, then you know you need to take 7 to 10 days to get it cleared out, you know. But
yeah, I used to come there every time I was in Indianapolis. I would walk down and have dinner by myself in that place. It's a really cool place.
I've honestly yet to go. I know that as a native Hoosier, that's like sacrilegious, but it's like $100, you know, to go out. So it's pretty expensive.
It's super expensive. I was living large in those days because I was a road manager for a rock band, you know? So you got like a per diem, you know, they gave you money to eat every day. Basically you get $100 like spending money. And that, to me, that's a lot of money. So like I would go treat myself to a nice dinner when I had a day off. But all right. Well, dude, that's time flies, man. That's like 40 minutes we've been talking. Look what I got here, man.
Oh man, I love that. Thank
They're
you.
They're everywhere, brother. That's Jimmy Kennedy is our producer today, our guest producer. And his father was a great musician, much beloved musician in Indianapolis and Indiana and all the rock and Midwest Southern states. I've heard his work. It's incredible. You should look him up on YouTube if you get a chance. Because that man had some soul.
He did. He did. And I'll tell you, it means a lot to me. I know you've been around some heavy performers. So for you to say that my dad had talent, I know you've seen it firsthand up close. So it means a lot. I get the chills when I turn on some of my dad's tapes. They bring back a lot of good times for me.
Good, man. You can't fake the funk, brother. You know what I mean?
No, you either got the funk or you don't. You
can't fake it. You know, I was watching a documentary last night and they're interviewing Muddy Waters. And they were like, do you think these white guys, you know, they were talking about like Eric Clapton and, you know, the Stones and stuff. You think these white guys could ever sing like you? And he was like, no, you can't sing like me. You can't fake the soul. They ain't suffered a much enough. You know what I mean? But your dad had an old soul and it came out of him when he sang. And that's what moves people. It's not about fame. It's not about technique. You know, that stuff's important somewhat, but like, it's about making people feel something. You know, it's the same in comedy. Like, it's about making people laugh. You can't fake it. You know, like you might be a famous comedian and they might clap for you when you come out. But if you're not funny, you're not moving anybody. It's the same thing with a singer. You know, I've seen dudes at weddings that killed it, you know, that were like some of the best performances I've seen. And I've seen all the rock, you know, most of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions in the last 25 years. You know, I've seen a lot of epic performances, the Grammys, all that. Some of the best musical performances I've ever seen were just random people, you know, that were moving somebody in that particular room or that street corner, wherever it was. If it was working, you know, it works. And God doesn't care. You know, God speaks through musicians and he doesn't care if you're singing to 10,000 people or 10 people. You know, if you're moving their spirits, you're doing your job. And then your dad did that. So he was a professional, in my opinion.
Yeah, and one quick story that will relate to that. My dad was originally from Noblesville, Indiana. It's just north of Indianapolis. And he did a live concert event there called the Noblesville Street Dance. And so in his hometown, I'm on stage with him. And, you know, you talked in a couple other of your podcasts about that feeling that people, you could feel the energy among a crowd. Being in that element with my dad in the zone, feeling 10,000 people. It's powerful, man. Yeah. It's a powerful drug, and it's really cool to awesome. Feel that.
Yeah, man, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's cool that you identified that because that's what I chased. I mean, I stayed in my career because of that feeling. And, you know, all you have to do is have an open heart and you'll get that feeling. And it doesn't even matter who the musician is. You might think like, oh, I'm not into that person or that's not my kind of music. If they're bringing it and you're lucky enough to be there, you're going to feel it. You know, Alicia Keys always makes me cry for some reason. I always end up on these shows and it'll be like Global Citizens in Central Park, or we used to do she came and did this polo event I did every year on Governor's Island. There's something about when she starts to sing, and she's a great singer, but not the most soulful person, you know, I wouldn't think she's not like Aretha Franklin, who I've worked with too. You know, it isn't necessarily an obvious thing, but there's something about the connection she has with her audience. And she's a wonderful singer and musician, don't get me wrong, but like, there's something about every time I see that girl sing, I cry. And I was at her first gig ever. She was, her first big public gig was at the VMAs. Because Aaliyah had just died tragically, you know, in this plane crash in the Caribbean. And she, Aaliyah was going to perform on that VMAs. And then she was dead like a week, you know, before the show. So Clive Davis was, you know, very involved in Alicia Keys' career. So they're like, use Alicia Keys, who was basically kind of an unknown, you know, and came out at the VMAs and just killed it. And she was a kid, you know, too. And it was like, man, that's a lot of pressure. You know, you're filling in for this woman who's already passed away, who was at the peak of her career, and you're basically kind of an unknown. That's a tough thing that can go either way. And it went, you know, it went to the stars, and now she's, you know, she's a legend in her own right. But my point is, like, I'll be sitting there in a suit doing my job at a polo event or something, you know, the game, like when they're riding horses. And because you do a lot of weird events when you do what I do in New York. And I'll see her singing to a crowd and I'll start crying. You know, it moves me. And, you know, I used to be kind of embarrassed about that. Now you just feel it, man, because there's only so many times in life you're going to feel that, you know, and it's like sun on your face, man. When you feel the spirit, you got to open your heart and drink it in, because that's what sustains us, brother.
The one song that always gets me, because the first Super Bowl that the Colts won, I worked with the Colts for a couple of years, you know, Prince played. So
I was there.
I always had a real, real connection with Prince, and, you know, it's raining during that Super Bowl and he plays Purple Rain, you know? And so I always had a connection to that song. And anytime I hear it now and I really listen and try to connect with it, I cry because I think of my dad, you know, watching the Colts win.
Yeah. That was a good day, man. That was that I was there. And, I, you know, obviously Prince was crazy, you know, crazy great. He actually didn't want to play that day. He wanted them to run the tape of the rehearsal that we'd done on the Thursday when it was sunny out. And the producers were like, you have to play. It's raining. Like, if we play a tape of you playing in the sunshine, like, everyone's going to know it's us, you know? So he rose to the occasion and killed it. You know, nobody was better than Prince. I worked with him on other things. That was the penultimate moment, besides the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where he played that great solo too on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. But I remember when that thing started, I was like, I stood on the field, because we do all the pregame stuff too, you know, the anthem and all that kind of junk, the coin toss. So the entertainment crew is on the field for all that. And I was sort of new to the gig. And I was like, all right, let me stay on the field for a minute, you know, because the team was all the way, you know, the Chicago Bears were like, kick receiving, right? So they're at the opposite end of the field. So I stayed in the end zone, right? Like at the north part of the field. And I'm like, well, let me stand on the field and watch this first play. And I'm standing there with a buddy in the end zone, right? And all of a sudden, you see this guy running towards us with the football after getting the kickoff. And it was Devin Hester. And he runs into the end zone. And like a ref comes over and yells at us, like, get the hell out of here. What are you doing? And, you know, we were only there because the odds of like a guy running the entire length of the football. But if you remember, he scored a touchdown. You know, I think it was the only touchdown I think they got. That was Rex Grossman too, right? I remember seeing him in the hallway afterwards, and I looked him and then just looked away because he was so unhappy. And I'll tell you one more story and then we'll wrap it up. But you know, I've been to Colts games. I used to work for Steven Stills, who was good friends with your owner and stuff. And he was also good friends with the Mannings, who were a great family. And another time I'll tell you the who's the middle Manning, who's the one, the Giants, Eli Manning. I'll tell you the Eli Manning stories, because I've been there where they all hugged after he won the Super Bowl in Phoenix, you know, when the Giants beat them.
Oh, man.
I've done some crazy things around those guys. But I remember walking around the field. I think the Colts were in another Super Bowl. I think they played in New York as well against like the Seahawks or something like that.
They played another one against the Saints. In Miami. Yeah.
Was I okay? And did they win or they lost?
They lost.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that one too, right? That was a fun after thing, because I remember partying with the Saints was insane, but on the field, like, they threw down. But anyway, I remember I would we sort of had access to the field before the game. So you just walk around and take selfies and like post it on Facebook. So your friends could be like, dude, how the hell are you on the field at the Super Bowl? Right. And I remember walking over to the Colts side, and I would walk like right up to where the players were. Right. And what's his name? What's the Manning? What's the main, your guy, the Colts?
Peyton Manning.
So Peyton is, I'm not a sports guy if you can't tell. So
That's all
Peyton is,
right,
it's
man.
all wasted on me, right? So Peyton
Yeah.
is like stretching his hamstrings, right? And he's just stretching his hamstrings and he looks up and I'm like 10 feet from him and he looks up at me with his game face, right? With his eyes so intense. And I was like, oh my God. And I just like turned and walked away because it was like seeing a killer. Do you know what I mean? He just looked up like, what is this little punk doing standing there? And probably saw through me, but he had his, he was prepping because he was about to be in the Super Bowl in 10 minutes. You know what I mean? And like, here's a smiling idiot like taking pictures. And he just, I'll never forget the look in his eye because it was like, damn, dude. And then you met him in life and he's like, hey, how you doing? He's like a goofy guy, you know, nice guy. But damn, I'll never forget the intensity that he had in his eyes, you know, it was like he was a great champion, great player, man.
Yeah, no, he's the greatest of all time, in my opinion. You know, Tom Brady has more championships, but as far as talent, Peyton Manning, that's the guy. That's
Absolutely.
the guy I'm taking.
Tom Brady gets no respect in this house, baby. That's the reason I stopped doing the Super Bowl because I got sick of Tom Brady and Patriots fans and flying across the country with them. Because you know, you have to travel to the Super Bowl. And I would always be in the airport with these lunkheads from Boston, you know, and I'm a New Yorker, so we kind of hate each other anyway. We're basically cousins because we're both obnoxious Northeasterners. But like, man, I just got so sick of it, you know, and just this year was just awful. And the year they came back against the it was the Southern team. They
The
came back.
Falcons, yeah.
Oh God, that was the worst. Because here's the
Oh.
thing, their fans only want to win and they're the horrible sports, right? So like they don't even look at the plays, they just want to see the score. But they'll turn around and turn their back to the field because they're like, don't tell me what happens unless Brady scores, you know, unless we get a, you know, fourth down, don't even tell me. Like they don't even watch the game. They just want to win and walk out of there and be like, oh, we won. So but I got to watch them get their asses kicked twice. Once on your home field, you know, that second 2012 or whatever, they got their butts kicked in that horrible cold Super Bowl in
We
Indianapolis.
take pride in that. We take pride in that.
Lucas Oil Stadium. That was like, yeah, well, I don't want to insult you. That was not the funnest town to have a Super Bowl in, brother.
Well, yeah, like I told you in the first pod that we did, that's warm for February, man. You gotta take count your blessings in Indy, you know.
I hear you, brother. I remember walking to the NFL experience like the day before the game, and it was all like tented in. It was right near the stadium on a street, you know, and it was just like miserable, like freezing rain and everything.
I wonder if we'll get another one, you know, but it was
I
fun
know.
to have the one,
Yeah,
you
we had
know.
Madonna there. I think Madonna was our, was, no, Madonna wasn't
Was
the,
it?
was it Madonna?
I know that CeeLo Green dropped like 100,000 in one indie strip club. I do know that.
Yeah, that makes
It was
sense.
pretty heavy amount, but
Yeah, I had to fish him out of a swimming pool in Las Vegas once at the VMAs with Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl threw him in the swimming pool. And then Dave jumped in, and then me and Dave's manager were trying to get him out of the pool at an after party. But I'll tell you that story another time, brother.
Yeah, absolutely.
All
Looking
right.
forward to it.
So we ran up some pod. All right. So thanks for tuning in, guys. My guest producer today was the great Jimmy Kennedy. He has his own podcast. Why don't you tell him about your podcast and where they can find JPK on air?
JBKonAir.com is the website. You'll find all the different locations you can get the podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and also on SoundCloud. If you search JBK on Air, it should come up.
Check it out, guys. I'm on one of those episodes. So is the great Brent Terhune, right?
Yeah.
So is Corey, Buttermilk guy, right?
We just had well, we also had a couple guys from the Bob and Tom show. Anybody from the Midwest that listens to that syndicated show. My dad worked for their band in the 90s, so I know a bunch of those guys. So, we get some guests on there. I try my
Okay.
best.
It ain't about the guests anyway. It's about the host, man, right?
Exactly.
Right on,
Exactly.
brother. Well, you're a good dude, and I appreciate you coming on the show today, man.
You bet. Absolutely.
All right, thanks. Be well, man. Say hi to Indy for me.
Will do. Take care, man.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.